The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory straight at the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Actually, her image subconsciously mocks that lineage.
So that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're going to share two views of how the Me Too movement has hit American culture. One comes from an evangelical activist. The other comes from Molly Ringwald, who starred in John Hughes's classic teen films of the 1980s. She'll talk about the things in those films that don't quite feel right to her now that she's an adult and now that our views of male behavior have changed dramatically.
I don't want to imagine a world where somebody basically mistreats my daughter and that she doesn't expect an apology.
That's later this hour. In the past week, an avalanche of stories about Donald Trump's zero-tolerance policy at the border and its appalling consequences for the children taken from their parents finally caused the president to modify that policy with an executive order. Among the reporters doing that critical work was The New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer, who's been reporting in El Paso, Texas.
I am in a parking lot across the street from the ICE processing center. I'm just standing outside in the heat outside my car.
John had just walked out of an ICE facility. He wasn't allowed to call from inside, but he had gotten permission to interview a woman named Ana Maritza Rivera, who was being held there.
She is being processed to be deported. She's in the deportation process, and it's now just a matter of days before she is put on a plane and flown home to Honduras. And so she's waiting to see if she can get reunited with her 5-year-old son.
Trump's executive order on Wednesday stopped the forcible separation of children, but it did nothing to address the more than 2,000 children who are already in federal detention. Rivera's son, Jairo, is just one of them.
So Ana Maritza and her son crossed the U.S.-Mexico border, or attempted to cross the U.S.-Mexico border, on midnight on May 5th. She was a part of a big group of Hondurans who were attempting the trip from Ciudad Juarez. They attempted to go under one of the international bridges, and then from there sort of scurry over a bit of wire fencing. And they did not get far before they were surrounded by Border Patrol agents and all of them arrested. And the Border Patrol agents then took them to El Paso to begin their criminal charging and their deportation process. And so Ana Maritza described being in a pretty big cell with about 25 other women and their children. The men from the group were in a separate cell with the kids that they came with. And the first night she's with her kid. And she's kind of waiting to see what happens. And then the second day in the afternoon, two Border Patrol agents enter the cell. And these two agents just start to try to remove her son, her five-year-old son, from her. And she starts to scream and cry and claw at them. Her kids, she describes specifically the feeling of her kids' arms kind of clinging to her and pulling at her. And the two Border Patrol agents managed to wrest him from her. She resisted. She was extremely upset, crying, yelling, asking what was going on. I asked her if the other women in the cell were shouting or trying to do something. I think all of them were just so shocked. And what she explained to me was that she was the her son was the first from this group to be taken from a mother. And so I think in some ways what may have happened was that they didn't even really understand, Maritza nor any of the other women really understood what was going on. And that was mostly what she described. It wasn't her grief sort of manifested itself in an odd way. It wasn't as kind of stormy and obvious as you'd expect. It was just she just seemed dazed. She almost seemed out of it as she tried to describe what this stuff was. And I think she was very confused in the moment about what was happening. And then sure enough, it became clear to her over the next few days that she and her son were going different ways, because from then on, they took her to in front of a judge to charge her with the illegal entry. And from there, she was transferred to U.S. Marshal custody. From there, she was eventually transferred back to immigration detention. And it was about 2 weeks before she even learned where her son was. And the way she found out wasn't because anyone took her aside and explained to her what was going on, but it was because she was now back in immigration detention, and she was just kept entirely to herself, was crying, wasn't eating. And another woman, a Guatemalan woman who had a 1.5-year-old son who had also been separated from her, recognized that Ana Maritza was in distress, walked up to her and said, "You should try calling this number. I couldn't find my kid, and this number is for a case manager who was in charge of my kid while we were separated." And all the number is, it's the name of a woman, and it's a phone number in the U.S., corresponds to Chicago. And Ana Maritza, at the time, didn't have money on a phone card to call from inside the ICE detention center. So this woman let her use her phone card, and just through sheer good luck, when Ana Maritza called this number, the person who answered in Chicago, case manager at a facility run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is in charge of handling these kids who've been separated from their parents, picks up and is thrilled to hear that it's Ana Maritza, because this woman, in fact, was at a loss as to what to do because they couldn't figure out who this child's mother was. And then this past weekend, Ana Maritza learned that her son had been transferred to a facility just outside of El Paso. And so that seems to bode well in that at least he's closer. She still can't see him. She now has a number for another case manager who deals with her son every day. And she said to me at one point, you know, she said, I can't, he's, when he talks on the phone, he sounds sad. He begs me to come pick him up. He says, Mom, take me home. I want to go home. I don't like this. And all she can say is, be patient. We're almost there.
Up until last week, even as outrage was growing, zero tolerance was being defended by the administration as merely a matter of law enforcement.
The argument the government gave was these people are entering the country illegally because they're not entering the country through an official port of entry where Customs and Border Protection have kind of a hub. And that's a pretty dubious claim to start with, because people who are seeking asylum don't only have to go through a port of entry to seek asylum. They can cross the border and say, I'd like asylum, and they should be given a chance to make their case. But the argument made by the administration and by Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, was that amounts to a loophole that has to be closed. People are gaming the system. We have to arrest anyone who crosses the border illegally. And so there's this immediate moment of rupture when a parent and a kid cross together under zero tolerance. The parent goes first into the custody of U.S. Marshal and eventually appears before a judge. The judge charges the parent. That parent then goes back to the custody of the Department of Homeland Security, immigration, detention. The parent's child, in the meantime, goes down an entirely different route. The parent's child goes into the care of the Department of Health and Human Services, and more specifically, an office inside the Department of Health and Human Services called the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Typically, the Office of Refugee Resettlement handles child migrants who come to the U.S. seeking asylum alone without their parent. And so the entire legal process for handling that child is entirely independent of the legal process that takes place for the parent. And there is no alignment between the two. And so that's how you're getting parents in immigration detention who don't know where their child is. They then have to, through their own force of will and through the aid of advocates and lawyers, start to piece together where their child is. And this was formally announced last month. But the actual policy itself dates to the summer of 2017. And it's been going on since then in more limited fashion along different patches of the border. And it's hard to know the full scope of it. The only numbers we have are from the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security says that it's been over 2,000 cases over the last 2 months. And yet at the same time, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, has also said that there is no policy for separating families. So it doesn't leave you with much confidence that the government's numbers are accurate or representative.
As John and many other reporters have found, the bureaucratic chaos has left people like Anna Maritza with essentially no help at all from the government to navigate the system and find their children.
At a certain point in our conversation, she stopped and she looked at me and she said, "This isn't going to hurt my case, is it?" And typically when I'm asked that by someone in some state of immigration detention, it's because they don't want something from an interview to come out and hurt their case for staying in the U.S. Anna Maritza's concern was exactly the opposite. She said to me, I want to be deported as soon as possible. She really thinks that the faster she can get out of here, the sooner she can be with her son. The hardest part for us, I think, the hardest part for me in this conversation is what she said. She said, "I told this ICE official that if I get to the airport and my son is not there, you'll be killing me." And that's as far as she seemed even able to contemplate the prospect. She then said, "I will not board that plane. I will not get on that plane. I will not go anywhere if my son is not there." It was a very difficult conversation to have.
Jonathan Blitzer, speaking last week from outside an immigration detention facility in El Paso. We'll update you on Ana Maritza Rivera and her son when we learn more. You can find John's reporting from Texas at newyorker.com. Now in Mexico, policies like child separation at the border have fueled a surge of anti-U.S. sentiment that may change the course of politics and history in that country. On our podcast, Politics and More, John Lee Anderson talks about the upstart leftist candidate who is likely to take the reins from Mexico's ruling party, the PRI. That's Politics and More from The New Yorker. And there's more to come this hour, so please stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this month was the annual conference of the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest and most important gathering of evangelical Christians.
Hallelujah, one day we'll see him.
The conference marked a change in direction for the SBC, a growing openness to women and minorities, and a growing distance from the Republican Party of Donald Trump. At the very same time, outside, there were protests directed at the church's stance on women's issues, in particular against pastors who have counseled women to tolerate and accept domestic abuse. One of the protesters was Autumn Miles. Miles is an evangelical leader who for some time has been urging reforms within the church because she herself is a survivor of abuse. Autumn Miles spoke with The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold.
Do you think, Autumn, that the Me Too movement has really caused a shift and even a rift within the evangelical community? I mean, are we seeing greater tension between those who want change and those who want to kind of grasp conservative principles?
I think it's doing both. I think a shift needed to happen. It had to happen. We have to do a better job at supporting, helping, and aiding these victims of any kind of violence. That is the heart of Jesus. I know Jesus personally, and I know that he would not want any one of his children abused. A rift, yeah, that as well. But you know what? A rift, I'm okay with a rift for the shift.
So you've talked to me about the fact that this is just the problem of domestic abuse is really it's within the church and within a small group of pastors, including those figures like Paige Patterson. Mm-hmm. Paige Patterson, of course, being the recently ousted president of the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you told me that I found so powerful was that when you heard Patterson's comments saying to a woman who had received, you know, so much abuse at the hands of her husband to go back, mm-hmm. that the idea there of submission and its scriptural roots, right, is part of what your own abuser used against you. Could mm-hmm. you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. It is very, very often that I hear that abusers, if they are in the church, will tell their victims, you have to submit to me, and in order to control their victim. And the victim, knowing that that scripture is placed in the Bible, wives submit to their husband is what I'm talking about. They will do whatever the abuser says. So, the very word submission in the Bible is actually the word hupotasso, which means to willingly place yourself under. It's not a force. It's a willingly placing yourself under an individual, and we see that played out with Jesus on the cross. He willingly submitted himself to the authority of God and went to the cross. When I heard the comments, the dialogue back and forth that was said by Paige Patterson, I cringed. This is not just happening in the SBC. This is happening in churches, period. And it's a great opportunity for all churches to look at what's happened very recently in the SBC and say, I don't want that to happen to my church. I need to put a plan in place to protect these precious victims that even as we speak, Eliza, are right now suffering in silence. While we're speaking, there's a woman that's involved in a church that's getting beat up by her spouse right now. We have to do a better job at taking a nod from what happened at the SBC this past week and changing the entire church culture by telling the church at large, domestic violence is not okay. And the reason it's not okay is because it's not the heart of Jesus.
Okay. So you married your high school sweetheart, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about that first marriage. What was that like?
Well, I started dating my high school boyfriend when I was about 15 years old. And, you know, it started off pretty typical. I was very infatuated with him. I, you know, I remember him just slowly looking at me and saying things like, you're fat, which what girl wants to hear that? Nobody. You're ugly. You know, little things like that. You're stupid. And at first, it jarred me. Like, why is he saying this to me? But we had been in a relationship long enough to where I felt like I loved him and maybe he was telling me the truth. And he asked me to marry him. I said yes. We were married 9 months later. And things got really bad after we got married.
You've told me that at some point the sadistic games were so bad that you would even say, you know, just hit me, just get it over with.
I remember it very clearly one night. Everything was so bad psychologically and mentally, the games that he was playing with my mind and really that even at that point I was probably playing with my own mind, lies that I had believed and stuff like that. There was one night that I lay in my bed. I had not gone to sleep. I was terrified of death. I thought, at this point, God hates me. My husband hates me. I can't tell anyone because my dad is the pastor of this church. I don't want to embarrass them by telling my parents that I am in a bad marriage. And so I started contemplating suicide. And as I was really planning my own death, the Spirit of God spoke to me and said, do you remember me?
I think it's so remarkable and important to underscore that for you, you know, it's really this personal experience that you had with God that gave you the confidence to get out of your marriage, right? That's really,
yes.
So just to pause on that and say, you know, that is what motivated you, because I think sometimes from an outside point of view, we don't understand that kind of flexibility within the church, that kind of empowerment, you know, and I think it's important just to note that. So you got up the courage, you know, to ask for a divorce, to file for the divorce, to tell your parents who were remarkable in supporting you, and then you had to tell the church. Yeah. So you went to a group of church elders. Tell us what happened.
The way the Baptist church that I grew up in was structured is that there was a deacon board, and that's kind of how they handle these types of situations. And they looked at me and they said, you know, if you file for divorce, God's never going to use you. You have to rescind the divorce. And if I decided to follow in my keeping my divorce, they were going to do what's called church discipline, which is to kick me out of the church. And so what these men were telling me didn't resonate with the Jesus I had met at 3 a.m. in the morning. So you're dead on. My courage came from my relationship in Christ. And I know that I was not the only situation that was handled poorly by the church that that I was in.
So when we're dealing with some of what are the biggest hot button issues in the church today, one of the things that's come to the fore as a result of the Me Too movement is the role of women's leadership in evangelical communities. Right. And that's really being questioned in profound ways. Complementarianism has to do with church leadership and the relationship between a man and a woman being able to lead a church. Now, in conservative circles, people will say women cannot be leaders in the church. At the other end, people will say, you know, women can be head pastors. You lie in a role that says men probably need to be head pastors, but men and women can form co-pastoring teams, and that's biblical. Is that accurate?
That's exactly where I lie, right in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So some people might think that something like complementarianism, which rests the ultimate authority with the man in the relationship, might give men – like the remaining hierarchy within the church might give men license to demean women or to put themselves over women. Have you wrestled with that, or and can you help us understand that a little bit?
I would say not if it's done well. You know, this is going to, you know, not everyone's going to agree with this, but I have seen it done well. And I've seen pastors serve the women in their church. So there is a way that it can be done very unhealthily, but there is also a way that it can be done very beautifully where the pastor is serving. And so that is where I'm coming from when I see husband and wife co-pastors. I see it's a very beautiful thing. You know, the woman is not less important than the man, and the man is not less important than the woman.
Do you think that the evangelical community needs to rethink some of its approaches to gender roles in general?
I think having this conversation is a great start to talking about the gender roles in the church. It's a great conversation to have. If pastors are saying, I believe in women, women should be in leadership positions in their church, they need to back up what they're saying. I believe that this is a moment for us to learn from, for us to grow from. We can't just breeze past this moment. We need to take a hard look at our organizations and make some changes based on what we find.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you told me I couldn't even believe it, but that you've been called a heretic for this work.
Sure, of course. when you put yourself out there at all, you're going to get all sorts of things. You're going to be called a heretic. People aren't going to understand. They don't have the same passion. They haven't lived the same story that you have. But you know what, Eliza? If I can help one woman that is suffering today, I'll take all of those insults that are hurled at me.
So if you could make practical changes, what would they look like?
Really not respecting women is a matter of the heart. This is where we need to take a hard look inside of ourselves and say, listen, are we not elevating women to positions because of pride, because of religion, because of tradition? And if any of those things are the case, we need to change that. This is a time, Eliza, where our leadership and our pastors might need to repent.
That's a word that I hear, and I repent. Okay, so what does that mean, Autumn? Can you tell us what does repentance look like in practical terms in the 21st century?
Acknowledging that you're wrong. It's as simple as that. Acknowledging that you're wrong. Repent is one of those words where, you know, makes everyone cringe, and we don't use it very much because it's not politically correct. However, it's needed. We have to get past our pride in some of these areas. Say, you know what, I've been prideful. I haven't thought about this with grace. I haven't handled these situations as well as I could, and acknowledge that we're wrong, ask Jesus to forgive us, and move forward.
That was The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold talking with Autumn Miles, the founder of Autumn Miles Ministries. Eliza's new book is Amity and Prosperity, One Family in the Fracturing of America. Recently, we published an essay by the actress Molly Ringwald. Ringwald, of course, was the star of a series of movies by John Hughes in the 1980s, 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink, The Breakfast Club. Hughes wrote about teenagers, and especially teenage girls, with an insight and an empathy that really hadn't been seen before. But at the same time, writing when he did, he had some blind spots too, particularly when it came to how those girls were treated by the boys around them. In Ringwald's essay, she talked about how those movies look very different to her now that she's a mother of a teenager herself.
My feelings about The Breakfast Club really evolved over the years. I think it really wasn't until the Criterion Collection released it and I did an interview about it. By that point, my daughter was 14 years old. And it was after Me Too movement, I really started to feel uncomfortable with aspects of it. And I feel like it took me many years because of the affection I had for these movies and the fact that they're so great in other ways. It was just sort of an accumulation, I think, that really made me want to examine the movies.
As she's been grappling with those movies in the age of Me Too, Molly Ringwald sat down with another admirer of the late John Hughes, the writer and the director, Judd Apatow. Apatow made his name writing about the same kinds of characters that Hughes did. Lovable outsiders, goofballs, and the smart young women who have to deal with them.
First of all, I'd like to say that I feel like we're coming full circle here because your daughter, Maude, interviewed me for Rookie, and now I'm interviewing you. So
I feel like somehow our other children need to get involved in that.
I think so, too. Well, the reason why I really wanted to talk to you is because of this piece that I wrote for The New Yorker about my feelings about the films that I made with John Hughes. And I think you, more than any other filmmaker, is seen as having taken over the mantle in a way of John. I mean, you can kind of make a connection between your films and his.
Well, I think with the influences, you know, sometimes you're not aware how deeply influenced you are unless you sit down like this to really think about it. You know, when I was in high school, that's when all of the first John Hughes movies hit. You know, Ferris Bueller.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
And 16 Candles.
Chronologically, you're 16 today. Physically, you're still 15.
And Breakfast Club.
I assume that you like the movies when they came out.
Well, I had a very strong reaction to Anthony Michael Hall.
And what was that?
I probably felt like, I think I'm a little bit like that guy. I'm a stringy, funny, abused young man. I was a forgotten young man who thought I deserved better. And there was something about his spunk that I connected with.
This information cannot leave this room, okay? It would devastate my reputation as a dude.
No problem.
I've never bagged a babe. I'm not a stud. I got the rep in sixth grade, and it stuck with me. I'm still on hold. Look, I appreciate you not laughing at me, okay?
I'm sorry.
I really appreciated the way he wrote about young people and their problems It was very real in a way I hadn't seen before on television. I mean, this was the time of Eight is Enough, and it definitely was a precedent for, you know, some of the nerd work on a show like Freaks and Geeks, which I worked on.
Right.
You know, the whole point of Freaks and Geeks to its creator, Paul Feig, was to tell the story of Lindsay Weir.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, followed in a tradition of some of the great parts that you played. Smart women in high school who are trying to figure out who they are, aren't sure where they fit in. Being smart makes it more difficult because you see how lame everybody is. And so to me, I feel like that's work we've been doing all along, but we've also enjoyed making movies about, you know, immature men and how they grow up and how they learn certain lessons.
Yeah. You know, I saw the movies completely differently when I made them. And although I still have so much affection for them, it's complicated because there are certain things that I feel very uncomfortable with as a feminist and as a mother. When I made The Breakfast Club, I never really thought, the only thing, as I mentioned in the piece, is there's that one part of the movie where John Bender goes under the table and he looks under my skirt. And although you don't really know, you assume that he grabbed my character or, you know, or did something. And I remember at the time that sort of really bothering me. But other than that, the whole seduction, which John Bender really does sexually harass Claire, or you could see it that way, through the whole thing, never apologizes but still gets the girl, which, yeah. When I think about it, it kind of bothers me. You know, I don't want to imagine a world where somebody basically mistreats my daughter and that she doesn't expect an apology.
Face it, you're a tease.
I'm not a tease.
Sure you are. Sex is your weapon. You said it yourself. You use it to get respect.
No, I never said that. She twisted my words around.
What do you use it for then?
I don't use it, period.
Oh, are you medically frigid or is it psychological?
I didn't mean it that way. You guys are putting words into my mouth.
Well, if you just answer the question.
Why don't you just answer the question?
Be honest. No big deal.
Yeah, answer it.
Answer the question, Claire.
Talk to us.
Come on.
Answer the question. Don't be a jerk.
It's easy. It's only one question.
No! I never did it!
When I've put on movies that I liked as a kid, with my children, I had the same experience as you. I remember putting on The Blues Brothers for my daughter when she was 9 or 10 years old, and I didn't realize how filthy it was. I mean, there was some really dirty stuff, and I noticed that in a lot of these films. They're way dirtier. They have way more sexual content. There is a lot more, you know, smarmy treatment of women.
Does it diminish your enjoyment now when you watch movies that wouldn't be made now? If you go back and watch them, are you able to say, oh, well, that was just the way it was back then? Like, for instance, I was trying to watch Breakfast at Tiffany's with my daughter. And when it got to Mickey Rooney's portrayal of an Asian person, I stopped. I mean, I just, like, you know, abandoned it entirely because as much as I love Audrey Hepburn, I just couldn't. I couldn't do it.
Well, there's so many jokes that you wouldn't do from the past. So The question is, how are we supposed to feel about jokes that we wouldn't do now? One of the first comedies I saw that was R-rated was Animal House, National Lampoon's Animal House.
Yeah.
And it is a sea of very troubling jokes.
Yes.
When you watch it in 2018.
Yes.
In a way, you know, it holds up and is very funny, but you definitely blanch a bunch of times, like, wow, I can't believe they did that.
Yeah.
And we all feel weird that we loved it as well. Like, we all laughed our asses off at every Long Duck Dong joke.
Yeah.
What's happening, hot stuff?
Now we go, oh, I feel a little weird about some of that. And I assume that will happen with my work, where
yeah.
people will watch it in the future and go, whoa, how did they, you know, how did they think that was okay to do?
When I wrote the article about my feelings about John Hughes, I had an incredible amount of anxiety because this was somebody that I really loved, and I love the films that I made in so many ways. So to write anything critical about them at all was just really anxiety-inducing. And also, I feel like so many people have had their sort of memories in some way attached to these movies. And I also think, you know, well, how would he have felt about this? Would this have hurt him? And I know that one of your actresses criticized the movie Knocked Up. Was that hurtful to you? And did you feel like her criticism was valid at all or not?
Well, I think that we certainly were trying to show very strong women. That was my intention. And I was playing with the idea of revealing how angry women get. You know, mm-hmm. if some stoner gets you pregnant, you might be pissed off.
Yeah.
Here it goes. I'm pregnant.
Fuck off.
What?
What?
I'm pregnant?
With emotion?
With a baby. You're the father.
I'm the father.
Yes.
And that was the point of the movie, which is that Seth Rogen's character, you know, had to put the bong down and learn to respect this woman who he is now about to have a baby with. Part of what made it funny was how bad the place he was at the beginning. And Catherine was incredible in the movie. You know, her acting couldn't be better, and she was really, really funny, but she was tough as hell with Seth, and it really is what makes the movie work.
Yeah.
I think when she watched it, she wished that she was lighter and more fun like the guys. And, you know, it's certainly, you know, it's fine for everyone to have an opinion. It hurts me because I love her in the movie, and I had a great time with her, but it definitely was intentional to have her be, you know, tough and strong in the movie.
I'm just saying, when you're a guy and, you know, you have a family and you have responsibility, you lose that male camaraderie. And I get that. I totally understand where he's coming from.
Why do guys always go to that place? You miss male camaraderie. What do I give a shit? Go hang out with your bearded freak friends. I don't care. You want to hang out with guys that look like the shoe bomber? It's all on you, man.
Well, what the fuck am I supposed to say to that?
You should just support me, you know? You should just support everything I say, because at this juncture in my life, I'm allowed to be wrong.
So if you're wrong, I have to...
Characters are supposed to be flawed, and a lot of times they're supposed to learn lessons. So we can't really make movies where everyone is great and respectful the whole time, because then there's no drama and there's nowhere to go. But... you know, times have changed, so you certainly could make the argument that the guys wouldn't start in that place right now. I would hope that now young people are learning how to treat each other much earlier, and there's a very open conversation happening right now, which is very important.
For the record, I think we should say that you've been a champion of the whole Me Too movement, but... there are people that you've worked with who have been accused of behaving inappropriately. How do you handle that when it's people that you know and that you've worked with a great deal?
Well, part of it is that I know people on both sides of it. I know people who have been accused, and I know accusers. And it's really tragic. Mm-hmm. A lot of people feel like there's no way to speak publicly without somehow messing it up. And so there's no way to communicate your point of view about it. And at the same time, accusers feel like they're not being taken seriously. They're not being believed, and nothing is changing. But overall, in the big picture, we are talking about something that nobody has ever talked about before. How badly women are treated, how they are disrespected in ways that men haven't paid any attention to.
Yeah. I consider myself lucky because I was never raped. And, you know,
yes.
Considering, I feel like I came out relatively unscathed, although there were tons of inappropriate instances.
How are you able to protect yourself?
It's really hard to say, because if I say, I was a strong person, it makes it sound like I'm saying that those women weren't strong, you know? So I don't really know. I think it was a combination of things. I think my parents were very protective, and I also generally spoke up. I mean, when there was a film director who, stuck his tongue in my mouth when I was 14 years old, I spoke up and I talked to the makeup artist, and the makeup artist talked to the director's wife, and that never happened again. In fact, the director no longer spoke to me on the set.
Well, I think that things have changed in a way that can't be turned back. You know, it's amazing that a director can kiss a 14-year-old actress and get away with it. But I think we all know that if that happened today, that director would be fired immediately. So we do have that change happening. So let's hope that an enormous percentage of it just doesn't happen, because for the first time, people think, I'm going to get fired as the director if I do that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that fear has ever been there
in
the past.
It would also just be nice if it wasn't just the fear of being fired, if it was just, I won't
nice
do that because
people.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you could make the world any better in the sense of the amount of good versus evil people.
Yeah.
Every movie is filled with awful people. If you really researched who's in every movie, there's one or two terrible people. And so you would not watch anything if your bar was, I won't watch an awful person in a movie. But what I care about that matters is, how are we treating people right now? How are all people respected on a set? How is the crew treated? This is what we can do that's important. We can change how we do business. We can change who's in power so that the future is much healthier and more respectful than it has been in the past.
Agreed. I want to thank you so much for doing this.
Sure, thank you. It's a pleasure.
That was Judd Apatow talking with Molly Ringwald. You can find Ringwald's essay on John Hughes called What About the Breakfast Club? At newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a minute...
Queen Bee is a play on...
Beehive.
Beehive. Right? Yeah. So hive should be in the clue.
The fine art of constructing a crossword puzzle. You're looking at me like I'm going to come up with a clue.
Well, I'm curious to see where your mind goes.
Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
There's so much jargon here. I need to explain to you.
Exactly,
I'm going to slow down.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So the puzzles progress in difficulty.
If you're a crossword nut, you might recognize the names Anna Schechtman and Cameron Austin Collins. They are puzzle constructors who have contributed to the New York Times.
I can get through Monday, and then by Tuesday, I decide through pure sanctimony that this is a worthless pursuit.
Yeah.
Simply because it's beating me into
this
the ground.
This is what you have to, yeah, you turn on the puzzle. That's what you do.
Right,
now, Cameron
right.
and Anna are part of a team of five people doing puzzles for The New Yorker.
We just started publishing a weekly crossword a few months ago, and I wanted to figure out how they even begin to build a puzzle.
I start by consulting a list of words called my seeds, phrases or words that I just think are really interesting that I really want to see in a crossword puzzle. And let's say I want to use the word fashionista. I'm a very visual person in my grids. I just like grids that are aesthetically pleasing and unique. So I find a way to build something beautiful before I worry about any of the other words.
How do we collaborate on clue making? Let's do this.
Okay. I have examples.
Ah, later. Look at this. Literally under your hat.
Yeah, I really had all to, because right. Clues are hard to remember, honestly. You've done the New Yorker puzzles, or you haven't. Like, this would be one
let's
from...
Let's just say tears were rolling down my cheeks at
all right.
a certain point.
This one I like because it... It gets at that sort of intersection of the material quality of language and the sort of social quality, right? So it's Grande Dame of pop music.
Grande Dame of pop music. How many letters? You're counting with your fingers now.
I think six.
You think six. Madonna or Grande Dame. Queen, yeah, Bey.
No, that.
No, but I love what yeah, you're thinking. Yeah,
it's a great seed.
Yeah,
answer.
Absolutely.
The answer is Ariana.
Oh, okay.
Because Grande.
Yeah,
it's a visual play.
That's a very good clue.
Got it.
That's a very good clue.
Wow. All right, let's make some. Can we do that?
Sure.
All right. Let's.
I mean, we could clue for Queen Bey.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
That's a tough one. I don't know exactly how I'd start.
It's a proper noun. And it's a nickname.
The most proper.
Beyonce is famous enough that you could be clever.
In the clue, somehow, we'd have to make reference to the fact that it's a nickname. We couldn't,
right?
Because you wouldn't want someone to think that Beyonce was the answer, right? That would,
right.
Or, you know, Mrs. Carter. There's just a lot of different possibilities.
She's rarely right. referred to. Well, the new album.
In the new right. album, new there
album,
we go.
She's Mrs. Right. Carter. There you go.
Look at this.
I know. He's as up as we are. This is.
Give
this
me
is
a break. Give me a break. Because you're so, you know, it's just, it's ageist of you is what it is.
It's first really of all, another of great entry.
Ageism.
Yes. Yeah.
Mrs. Carter's handle. No, nobody would know Miss. That sounds like Dome's
well,
little
here's
pills.
The thing. Queen Bey is a play on, I mean.
Beehive.
Beehive. Yeah. So Hive should be in the clue.
Right. You're looking at me like I'm going to come up with a clue.
Well, I'm curious to see where your mind goes. But it's basically you look at the qualities of the word and you say, what are the things that are fairest? And like,
right,
this
let's
is
do
a royal title.
Do an easy one first.
Okay. Well, this is one of my favorites because it's actually quite simple. So how would you clue the word joy?
How would I clue the word joy? Ode to. But
that's a Monday.
But that's a Monday clue.
Yeah,
that's a
perfect,
great Monday clue.
They
Monday
said
clue.
Unbelievably condescending.
No, but that's
a Monday clue. David.
That's a great
Go
Monday clue.
Go sit in the corner and have a cookie. That's a Monday clue.
Can I just interject briefly?
Yeah.
What is amazing about this conversation is that you're actually trying to create some sort of rubric of what is a good word.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's just an amazing project to me. As a,
this is why we're the literary nerds.
It's like, what is the standard here?
And that is your, by the way, other work.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're an editor, you're a writer,
yes.
And you're a film critic.
We also both are...
We're somewhere in the realm of the PhD, and I'm in English. And
English and film and media studies. Yeah, we're busy.
I see. And you're doing the puzzle for us.
Yeah.
Right.
Instead of doing puzzles then to relax, you're doing them to heighten your workload.
You know why I'm doing it? I'm doing it because I was solving the New York Times crossword for a little while. It was mostly something that my mom did growing up, and I thought it was always too stodgy. But when I started doing them, this was in graduate school when I was craving something else to do, I just kept doing the puzzle and not seeing... I just felt there were a lot of missed opportunities for kinds of culture that could be in the puzzle. I want to see more bands that I like. I want to see more...
You want the puzzle to say something.
Yeah. I want to see more black people. I want to see black people who aren't Jay-Z or Nas, who are common in puzzles because of the letter combination.
Because of the Z.
Yeah.
Or an N-A-S. Yeah.
Consonants together.
Right.
So how have you accomplished that? Give me an example of puzzle clues that you've done that have... I diversified the world in some small way, or said something political, or said something interesting that you had a little tinge of pride in.
Yeah. Well, my debut puzzle for the New York Times, I published Anita Hill. I was the first person to put her in the New York Times crossword, which is late.
That's very late, because you're a young guy and Anita Hill's been around for a long time.
Yes, indeed. Gaberhood was something that I put in the puzzle. I put fan fiction in the puzzle.
I put Shtup in a puzzle.
Whoa, Shtup was in a...
Shtup, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'll help
with
the pronunciation.
This is one of the best... This is one of the best days of my crossword life.
So a Yiddishism for the sexual act, or one of them, is in one of your...
In the New York Times, yeah. Well, okay,
That's a proud moment of a kind. Yeah. Now, what identity are you trying to create for the New Yorker puzzle as opposed to all the puzzles that you've seen elsewhere?
I think the thing about the New Yorker puzzle is that the distance between when we make the puzzle and when the puzzle runs is very short. So that means you can be very up with things that are immediately happening in the culture.
So for us, it takes how long?
A month? A little over a month?
Yeah, that's nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nothing.
Although when it comes to usage, it might be. I mean, I remember one time when I was working at the Times, we had a submission that had amazeballs as the one across. And I remember thinking, God, I hope this isn't in common usage when this runs. I hope this is done. I hope we're not using amazeballs.
It had a very brief vogue.
Yeah. But that's one of the hard but interesting things, is like to try to put your finger on the thing that's not going to go out of favor in a couple of years or even a year, because also just you're kind of giving it that sort of cultural significance. I prefer to put things in there that are going to be around a little while.
What is the ultimate compliment that you can get for a puzzle that you do?
I think that any type of aha that you get in whatever form that it comes across to you is the most gratifying.
On the subway or in a coffee shop, there's truly nothing like seeing someone do your puzzle.
Well, they're getting in your brain with you. It's really creepy.
It's very strange to be on the subway and see someone on their phone.
So it's like seeing somebody reading your piece on the subway.
Yeah, but like wrestling with your piece, like trying to solve your piece.
It's participating with your piece.
Yeah, like in a conversation with you that they don't realize that you're there watching them have with you.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
It's like as if the comment section were actually gratifying, right? As opposed to...
Right.
What it usually is.
Yeah.
Now, this is a crucial question.
Yes.
When you think of your people doing this, your solvers,
yes,
are they cheating like crazy? Do they have their phones out?
Okay, I feel strongly about this. It's not cheating, it's learning.
Oh, my God.
I agree.
I don't know.
That was the most millennial thing you've said.
For sure. God. No, I just really believe that that crosswords have been formative for me educationally. So why would I?
So what you're admitting on the air?
Oh, that I cheat?
Like crazy.
Yes.
Do you cheat?
I don't cheat, but I approve of cheating.
I'm trying to figure that answer out. Well, I thank you both for coming here and for doing the puzzle for The New Yorker. It's a proud addition, and I'm delighted to have you here.
Thank you so much, really.
This is fun.
That was Cameron Austin Collins and Anna Schechtman, two of the puzzle constructors who make crosswords for The New Yorker. You can find a new puzzle every Monday at newyorker.com. Don't say I didn't warn you, because I have not finished one yet. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for this week. I hope you'll join us next time. And until then, keep up with us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all.
The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.